You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My parents were born and raised in a village north of Ramallah, and they came to the U.S. in the late 60s, and we were born and raised in Chicago. When I was 13 years old, my parents decided, like many middle-class Palestinian families in the U.S., that we needed a taste of our culture, religion, their heritage, and they took us to live in the occupied territories in the West Bank. Of course, not knowing that the first intifada would break out. I actually did not want to go. I really knew so little about Palestine. I had heard the words occupation, but I mean, it was not something that was forced down our throats, even though it was a big part of my parents' life and heritage. So in 1986, we moved to Palestine, and that was my introduction, basically. So those words, military occupation, which sounds so abstract to so many people, I can kind of understand why people wouldn't even be able to envision what it's really like, because I certainly couldn't. In fact, when I came back from Palestine after 2 years of high school education there, I didn't talk about anything I experienced for a long time, because I didn't have the words for it, I didn't have the vocabulary for it, and it was actually just too difficult to think about. And it was only later that I actually found the words to describe it. So I'm going to try to tell you a little bit of, I mean, probably most of you already know what military occupation actually means for the Palestinians who live in it. We've heard of occupation, but the majority of the time we hear it, we actually hear it from the perspectives of the occupiers. And it, of course, is a completely different experience for the people who are experiencing complete eradication of their rights. There is a structure of Israeli occupation that is basically meant to strip Palestinians of their civil rights, of their ability to develop, of their economic rights. It's practically impossible to have an economically viable business state because of all the checkpoints. So Israel actually does this through several ways. One is settlements. Another is checkpoints and roadblocks. Another is the permit system. Another is the wall. Another is the dual legal system, one for the Israeli settlers and one for the Palestinians living in the occupied territories. In the West Bank alone, there are over 190 Israeli settlements. They're built on confiscated Palestinian land, and Palestinians whose land they're built on cannot move into them. But many times the settlements actually take the agricultural land of the Palestinian villages, for example, my village. Much of the agricultural, it was an agricultural village, but now you hardly see any young men of working age who live there because they simply cannot survive economically, and they try to provide for their families by leaving. So a lot of times if you look in the streets, it's just very young people or very old people or women mothers. But what happens with the settlements is that they're built on Palestinian land, and then the Palestinian villages and towns and cities are no longer able to expand and develop because the settlements not only have their own built-up area, but they reserve huge spaces of land, of Palestinian land, so that they themselves can develop. So I remember when I was there as a teenager, one of the things that most disturbed me about the settlements, besides seeing them in settlers in the streets all the time with guns, is that many times our water in the village would be shut off, and the settlement right above us called Shiloh had, you know, just massive, their water was never shut off. They had you know, plenty of water to water things, for swimming pools, all of that kind of stuff. And our electricity would also be off and turned off. Theirs would not be turned off. That's how, you know, you kind of saw the difference. In the streets, we had to have different license plates, and in fact, color license plates. And that's still the situation there. Palestinians have to have blue license plates, and Israelis have yellow license plates so that Palestinians can easily be distinguished on the roads. And the road system is, of course, another way to control the population and constantly exert your power and let Palestinians know who's in control. In the West Bank alone, there are ranging from, at any given time, 500 to figures I've seen most often, 757 roadblocks and checkpoints throughout the West Bank. And I know that because of the media portrayal of this conflict, a lot of people assume that the checkpoints and roadblocks are often located on the border with Israel. But in fact, the vast majority of these roadblocks and checkpoints are located in between Palestinian towns and villages, separating Palestinians from each other, from their schools, from their neighbors, from their families. And the checkpoints and roadblocks are a huge source of humiliation for Palestinians. I can tell you stories. I'll just tell you one. One time, because in my village, the taxi stopped running around 4:30, and I was working late in Ramallah, and I needed to go to my sister's house in Jerusalem. So I tried to pick up a cab in Ramallah. Well, I did pick up a cab in Ramallah, and I went to Jerusalem. The thing is, my visa had expired. Because I'm Palestinian, I'm treated as a tourist because I'm Palestinian-American, and I only get 3 months to stay. So every 3 months, I had to go and renew my visa to be able to live there for this amount of time. So when I got to the checkpoint, I showed the soldiers my paper saying that my visa was being renewed. Not that it was being considered for renewal, but that it was in fact being renewed. And the soldier who stopped me at the checkpoint said, no, you just can't pass. I mean, it's that random. It's basically whim. And I actually seriously needed to get to Jerusalem to find a place to sleep that night. And I told him, you know, I have to go there because my sister's house is there. This is a permit, which, of course, the permit system itself is a bureaucratic way of maintaining Israel's occupation, a very detailed one, a really insidious way to control the population. And so anyway, he refused. So I saw the soldier got distracted by another Palestinian he saw and wanted to harass. So I went and talked to another one and said, you know, this guy is not letting me through. I have a right to go through, and this is not even a permanent border anyway, and I need to get to sleep. And so that soldier was actually about to say yes, and then the first one came along and just had to assert his power and said, I said no, you've got to go back. And I was, of course, really upset, and I said, you know what, well, I mean, you can't be both soldier and jury and judge, and I'm going to walk towards Jerusalem. And I started to walk, and then I heard yells behind me, and I looked back, and they were kneeling, a group of them, kneeling and pointing their guns, they're called M16s, at me. And, you know, I really didn't have a doubt in my mind that they would actually shoot me. And they would probably say I was, a terrorist, or I was threatening them or something like that. So I walked back. And as I walked back from the checkpoint towards Ramallah, you know, just a little way, they all started laughing at me because I had to go back. I mean, that's a simple story. I'm a patient person. So, I mean, I just said, well, I actually found another way to get to Jerusalem, of course. I just went around the hills. I didn't want them to win. But I mean, they actually, what kind of bothers me a little bit more is that I saw them doing this to Palestinian men all the time. And it's just really, really terrible to see that on the roads all the time with these men sitting on the sides and blindfolded. And, you know, just never, like, a constant state of insecurity, permanent state of insecurity, never knowing when a soldier will have a whim to, you know, try to humiliate you, send you back when you need to do something urgent in another town. But anyway, the thing is, the roadblocks and checkpoints actually serve to ghettoize the Palestinian territories, to ghettoize the West Bank. I mean, Gaza itself is completely surrounded. I mean, people cannot, it's been a sealed open-air prison for so long now. I mean, with just terrible consequences for the population there, huge poverty levels, major unemployment. I mean, creating a simmering pot, you know, just waiting for something to happen. But in the West Bank, there are hundreds of these, like I said, and they serve to ghettoize and isolate Palestinians from each other. Then there's the wall, the Israeli wall, which a lot of people, again, because our media doesn't tend to do its own investigative work, tend to believe that it actually does separate Palestinians and Israelis like the Israeli government claims. But in fact, the wall does not separate Palestinians from Israelis. It separates Palestinians from Palestinians. It separates Palestinians from their homes, from their agricultural land, from their neighbors, from their schools, from their hospitals. 80% of the wall is actually projected to be built deep inside the West Bank, not on the border. And in fact, it's meant that, the figures I forget, it's either 65 to 75% of Palestinian communities that live in proximity to the wall are now poor. They now live under the poverty level. And in one village in the north of the West Bank, which was traditionally an agricultural village, Israel basically took the agricultural land and the water resources, which the northern West Bank is pretty famous for, and it placed them on the Israeli side of the wall. So now the farmers on the north can't actually access their fields to work their fields without this extremely difficult to obtain permit. So at any given time, these farmers in Jayus, 65% of them cannot get a permit to access their land. And when you're all constantly trying to obtain a permit to farm your land one day here, one week there, I mean, it makes it just unviable. And so actually these farmers, the majority of them in Jayus depended on their olive groves for subsistence. They were very self-sufficient with their agriculture. And now the majority of people in Jayus are dependent on external food aid. So, I mean, the wall is just doing, and I think what Israel is actually trying to do is get the Palestinians to leave. Because if you're not able to make a living, like people in my villages did, I mean, in my village did, they left. And Israel is basically counting on the fact that these people, after a certain amount of time where they're dependent on food aid, and these are people with pride who've basically managed to have self-sustaining livelihoods for so long, you know, probably won't put up with it for that long. So basically, occupation itself is... I think what's going on in the occupied territories right now, the word military occupation no longer sufficiently describes what's happening. In fact, it's so actually far removed from what's happening now. The term now, I think, most appropriate for what's actually happening on the ground is ethnic cleansing. I mean, already Israel's got control of about half the West Bank, and the settlements take up these huge reserves of Palestinian land, preventing Palestinian towns and villages from developing, basically just pretty much creating all the conditions for Palestinians to leave. And South Africans, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, when they go to the West Bank, they pretty much consistently say that conditions in the West Bank and Gaza are not only as bad as they were in apartheid-era South Africa, but even worse. So, I mean, it's like if you actually go and see the West Bank and Gaza, I think you might actually have the reaction that I did when I lived there and that a lot of people do when they go and visit, which is it's just really, really hard to describe. So when we come and we actually talk about it, which I've always actually up until this year, I felt much more comfortable talking about the historical angle, the policy angle, but the human stories, just a few of which I've shared, but I mean, actually I'll share one more. I mean, as a teenager, when I lived there, it was during the first uprising, and I mean, it was just so horrible what was happening in the streets over there. I used to see the young men get harassed in the streets by Israeli soldiers all the time, get beaten up by Israeli soldiers. And if we got close to try to tell them, you know, to stop or to let them know that there are witnesses, they would keep shouting at us, "Ruh, ruh," which is go, go, and point their guns at us. And I mean, basically, we had to watch as other Palestinians Palestinian men got beaten up. And so I would plead with my father, please don't go into the cities. I couldn't bear him being at the end of that treatment. And I know two people who got shot in the back. And when we would be walking in Ramallah, I know other people have written about this, but I can actually testify to this. This is when we would be walking from Ramallah. I used to go to a Quaker school in Ramallah called Friends Girls School. And when we would be walking towards the taxis back to our village, these soldiers in this area in Ramallah called the Manara, it's a circle, pretty main place of Ramallah, they would be stationed on the top of the buildings. And they would constantly see us walking by and start yelling at us, I'll say it in Arabic first, Mamnu' tajawwal, because that's what they always say, which means basically that the street is closed. But we knew that the street wasn't closed because we always saw people passing by. So it was just them trying to harass us and let us know basically who was in control, which was a constant theme throughout my time there. And my sisters and I, as we were walking, we always refused to leave, to turn back and go away, because we knew that the street wasn't actually closed, and, you know, it was ridiculous. And so we would start walking by, so they would take these huge stones from on top of the buildings and dodge them at us. And, like, I would hear them banging against the store steel, the steel of the stores, and I actually thought they were bullets, and we would have our school bags like this, and one time they hit an old man who didn't even know what was happening when they were trying to hit us. And actually, my point here was, how did I deal with this as a teenager? And this is what I think of now, these people, these kids dealing with the Intifada now, and actually, the brutality of the army and of the settlers and of the government is even so much stronger than it was in the first one, when they had actually orders to break the arms of protesters, which they did. They would extend arms of people they saw protesting and take their sticks and just break the bones. But I think about that. How did I deal with it? I remember that I actually realized my parents can't protect me. My teachers can't protect me. Nobody could protect me. I turned to God. I made a promise that I would, you know, just let me live and I will be so good. I will start practicing my religion. And I actually did it for 1 year. I wore the veil. I prayed. And, I just felt like, God did keep me alive. So I did try to keep my promise. Here I am. And I just want to actually finish by saying that when we talk about what's happening in the occupied territories, when we actually try to tell the stories that so many people don't want told, I'm sure many other people have heard this, like immediately accusations of anti-Semitism, immediately accusations of, oh, you hate Israel, you want to destroy Israel, all of these things, anything but to look at what Israel is actually doing. Anything but that. I mean, so basically the bottom line, whatever the slander is, the bottom line of the message of the people who do want to keep this military occupation going, which I don't even know if I should use the word military occupation to actually describe what's happening over there. It's so much worse. What they basically are telling all of us is that Israel has every right to conduct its military occupation the way it sees fit. It has the right to kill Palestinians as it sees fit. It has the right to take their land, expropriate their land, steal their land as it sees fit. And it has the right, I mean, over the last few years, there's an average of 2 Palestinians being killed by Israel's military and settlers every day. There's 30,000 wounded in the last 6 years. So you have so many Palestinians walking around in the streets who are handicapped now for life. People paralyzed, little kids, all of this. And, you know, anything but to let the world know what's going on. Anything. And so we're just supposed to basically say, you know, I mean, the idea is for us to give in and be so afraid of being accused of anything to just say, you know, it's not worth it. But, you know, it is worth it. I mean, it's all connected. Our governments, I mean, Canada and the U.S. and the EU are all part of the countries and groups of countries who've decided to have an funds embargo on Palestine now, on the occupied territories, as if these 40 years, next year it will be 40 years of Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And that in itself creates a humanitarian crisis and disaster for all of these years. And on top of that now is another humanitarian disaster where Israel is withholding the taxes that it actually owes Palestinians, which I believe is about $60 million a month. These are not donations. This is not international aid. It's actually taxes it collects on behalf of the Palestinians and is obligated to give back. It's withholding that. And on top of that, the international community is withholding its international aid. So now you see these hospitals throughout the West Bank and Gaza, especially Gaza Strip, that don't even have enough medicine for the patients. In 1 month, I believe it was April, 4 patients died because the doctors had to cut back on their dialysis treatments. 160,000 Palestinian employees are now not getting paid. I mean, people who work in the health ministry, in the education ministry, and so many of them have still been showing up to work. Because they see the suffering all around them, but even they are now having trouble buying a bus pass to get to work. So there's, in some hospitals, they're diluting medicines now, even chemotherapy medicine, and where the Palestinian health ministry is the one that used to pay for transplants, organ transplants, kidney, and so on, the Palestinian health minister used to pay for them because it's, those kinds of treatments are not offered in the occupied territory. So they would have to take them to Israel or to Jordan or to some other country. Now the Palestinian Authority simply cannot afford to do that. These people are pretty much slated to die if this humanitarian disaster continues. And because the PA is actually also forced to make very, very tough decisions right now, which is, should we pay for a group of people who needs priority, like desperate help, which many people in Palestinian society are saying, yes, drop everything and help them. And then they have to decide, well, what about the millions who need electricity and fuel and all of this? I mean, it's an unconscionable decision that they're made to face. And I was actually asked to talk about current events. So all of this is actually current events. But on top of this is Olmert's convergence plan, which is basically an annexation plan, which he's been going around the world trying to sell. And the convergence plan is a little bit vague about statistics, but most people think it would be something like 45 to 50% of the West Bank that would be annexed, basically stolen, occupied Palestinian territory to Israel. And then the Olmert government is actually using the wall as a boundary. And that's the reason, that's one of the main reasons for the wall. It's meant to make, you know, to have this boundary where the agricultural land and the water resources are on the Israeli side. But this convergence plan is absolutely terrible. Olmert has said publicly that, yes, he will talk to the Palestinians. He wants to talk to the Palestinians, but he will carry out his convergence plan no matter what. So he'll talk, but if they don't agree, he's going to do it anyway. So negotiations are just a ruse. Which actually just leads me to my last point, which is I did work in negotiations for 2 years. After graduate school, I was a little bit idealistic. I had read the Oslo Accords. I knew about the fundamental flaws of not having this, not having international law and human rights law play any kind of role in negotiations at all. So it was purely a balance of power kind of negotiations where you automatically, I mean, the conclusion is, it's a foregone conclusion what's going to happen when you have a strong party and a weak party negotiating. But I mean, you know, I did know this, and I still thought that, I mean, it's worth trying to steer things in a direction that's like more just and more equal. And although I was doing policy work, I did attend negotiations for many of the negotiations, and I mean, the framework of negotiation simply has to change. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think this is obvious to everybody. I mean, it's not, negotiations aren't even taking place. But also, it was just horrible sitting through these things where the Israelis would make very clear that that international law was not something we could insert into the negotiations, neither was human rights law. It was simply, the bottom line was, in the end, it was how much they wanted to give us generously. So it was purely what they wanted to give, which is, of course, self-explanatory, what they want to give. So, yeah. Yeah, thank you for coming.